Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Washington, the inside scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the inside scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the inside scoop. Well, Barack Obama, the Democratic nominee, of course, is out in Europe and in the Middle East trying to win over support to show that he would be a strong commander-in-chief and trying to win over support at home for that. And he has a number of natural constituents, of course. The young people are heavily out for Barack Obama. But there is a constituency group that you might be very surprised that Barack Obama is going for. It's a constituency group that you would think would be his greatest enemy, white evangelicals. Those are the ones who you would think would be most leery of an Obama campaign. But Barack Obama is reaching out to everyone, and in fact, it is my honor and privilege today to have Barack Obama's evangelical coordinator right here on the Inside Scoop, Sean Casey. Welcome.
Hey, Mark. It's great to be with you.
Great to be with you. So, I mean, it almost seems for some people like a contradiction in terms. Evangelicals have been strongly, particularly white evangelicals, have been strongly identified with the Republican Party, at least since Ronald Reagan, definitely since George W. Bush. What makes you think they might consider Barack Obama?
Well, I think there's sort of a tidal wave going on, particularly among young evangelicals, that the basket of moral issues that they're concerned about is much wider than the sort of classical two hot-button issues that sort of the media stereotype has that evangelicals only care about. There's plenty of anecdotal evidence and empirical evidence that suddenly younger evangelicals in particular care for a much wider range of issues. And when you look at what those issues are, you see that there's a real opportunity for somebody like Senator Obama to communicate with those folks and make the case that the Democratic Party is the place they should be voting this time around.
Well, let's talk about these issues. The two hot-button issues, I assume, are abortion and homosexuality. Those are the issues that it seems evangelicals always get associated with, or at least have, over the last 20 years. Those are what you're referring to, right?
That's right.
Okay. So what would be the other issues? Would they be environmentalism, care for the poor, or what other kinds of things?
Well, exactly. I think global warming it's risen sort of in the national consciousness that young evangelicals have also realized that that's a huge moral issue. I would put global poverty, domestic poverty up there with it as well. I think the war in Iraq, interestingly enough, is a big issue. But the truth is evangelicals also put gasoline in their cars. They go to the grocery store. They go to the doctors. And so they feel the same sort of pressures in terms of lack of access to affordable health insurance. The downturn in the economy has had a huge impact. And so when you add that all up, they suddenly are seeing a whole range of moral issues there that they feel like the nation should be discussing and dealing with.
Let me ask you a little bit about your background. You are a professor. You teach at a theological seminary in Washington, D.C., is that an evangelical seminary, or is that open to all sort of Protestant backgrounds?
Yeah, it's an ecumenical seminary. We have a wide range of students. It's one of the most religiously and ethnically diverse seminaries in the country, so it's actually a great place to teach. We are really open to a variety of traditions, although the main core of our student body is, in fact, United Methodist.
And Professor Casey, do you, if you don't mind my asking, I assume it's a fair question, if you consider yourself an evangelical?
Well, I consider myself sort of multilingual. I grew up in a tradition called the Churches of Christ, which is a Southern evangelical denomination. I'm still a part of that. But I went to one of the great liberal divinity schools in America, Harvard Divinity School. I studied with a Catholic priest there, and now I teach at a Methodist seminary. So I consider myself to be a broad Christian, let's put it that way.
One of the things that interests me is, of course, labels. When I think of evangelical, I think of the label that we used, that I still use, I must admit, and that evangelicals themselves used until just a few years ago, the label of fundamentalist. To me, that described them much better, because fundamentalist meant someone who believed there were sort of rock-bottom principles. They took the Bible literally. Right. Evangelical just means, I don't know, spreading the word. I don't know. Are evangelicals fundamentalists, or are they two different people?
That's really two different things. I mean, the fundamentalist movement really traces itself back to the 1920s in the United States, where there was a publication called The Fundamentals that attempted to establish a kind of conservative orthodoxy. So evangelicals really typically began to distinguish themselves in the 40s, in particular in the United States, from fundamentalists. Now, sometimes in terms of political shorthand, folks lob them all together. But I think the important thing to see is that among this 25% of the American population, there's tremendous diversity. You, on the one hand, do have some very conservative folk, and on the other hand, you have some fairly progressive folk. And it's a highly decentralized world. Many times people look at the kind of the James Dobsons, the Pat Robertsons, the Jerry Falwells as somehow speaking for all of these tens of millions of folk, when in fact that's really not true. That there are all kinds of subcultures and independent communities under this broad rubric.
Well, Professor Case, I wonder if you could help my listeners and myself out with just, I guess, some definitions. How would you define a fundamentalist? How would you define an evangelical?
Well, the fundamentalists are usually fairly clear in their self-identity. I mean, they do believe in a very, literal interpretation of the Bible. They sort of think that their way is the only way, even within Christendom, that somehow one has to have a very narrow set. And typically that might represent, maybe 10% of the American population. Now, evangelicals even fight with each other. What does it mean to be an evangelical? You can't simply go to the dictionary and find one definition that even all evangelicals embrace. When you think about it politically, and this is where I think the most interesting thing is to see, is that typically now among evangelicals, about half consistently vote Republican, and they're probably not going to move very far from that base. But equally interesting, about 20% consistently vote Democratic. And so you're left with about 30%, almost a third of evangelicals who kind of migrate back and forth.
Well, Professor Case, let me just ask you, because I hate to bring it up, but it's true about American politics, obviously, that white evangelicals and black evangelicals vote very differently for long reasons because of our history that you and I know. We don't have to go into here. I'm curious, the 20% that vote Democratic, are those largely African-American evangelicals?
No,
are you including?
I'm talking about white evangelicals. Yeah. No, that does not.
All right. I just want to be clear what 20% you were talking about.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So I think that's what surprises folk, is that there's still, I mean, the stereotype out there is that all conservative Christians reflexively vote Republican. It's always been that way, and it's never going to change. And that narrative is simply false. It has really never been true in the United States that they always vote Republican.
So you're saying 50% vote Republican, 20% vote Democratic, and 30% are in the middle. Tell me, if you will, demographically or however else you can describe them, who are the 20% of white evangelicals that pretty consistently vote Democratic?
Well, they are religious progressives. I mean, you think about people like in the Sojourners Orbit, for instance. There's a group called
Jim Wallace, for example.
Right, and there's Ron Sider's group, Evangelicals for Social Action. So there is a long tradition that goes back to the 19th century of progressive evangelical social engagement and political engagement. And a lot of folks just don't have that historical memory. They don't realize that in some of the great social movements like abolitionism, for instance, that even in some parts of the freedom movement, in the anti-war movement of the 60s, there were, you know, a small subset of evangelicals involved in those efforts.
So pardon my ignorance, but what's the difference between a liberal evangelical Protestant Christian and a liberal Protestant Christian?
Well, I mean, you take somebody who's grown up, say, in, perhaps who grew up Mennonite, for instance. The Mennonite church, well, at least one of them is a member of the National Association of Evangelicals, so it's pretty clear they're in the evangelical tradition, but they're also pacifists. Okay, so you might find a Mennonite who's anti-war, for instance, who protested the Vietnam War, protested against the Iraq War. I would call that a liberal evangelical, somebody who's clearly sort of orthodox in their faith in a classic evangelical sense, but whose sensibility about war, about racial justice and reconciliation and poverty pushes them in a progressive public policy direction.
One of the things I've never really understood is the 50% you call Republican evangelicals. Okay, abortion, homosexuality, I get it. But, of course, Jesus never discusses abortion nor homosexuality in the New Testament. He talks a lot about caring for the poor, says it's easier for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than a rich man to enter heaven. He's no fan of the money changers. And yet you see some of these Republican evangelicals caring for things like a capital gains tax cut, which surely Jesus never cared about, talking about the poor, and focusing on two things which, I'm sure that they existed 2,000 years ago, abortion and homosexuality, really didn't seem to be foremost on Jesus' mind.
Well, you sound like an evangelical to me, Mark. You're doing quite well.
Oh, okay, am I? Maybe like a liberal evangelical, perhaps.
There you go. That's right.
I mean, but where does this come from? Maybe you can just back up a bit and explain to me when it was decided that issues of caring for the poor, which seems to me classic Christian, whether Protestant or Christian or Catholic idea, you know, caring for the environment, looking out for those least among us. I mean, if there's anything Jesus very clearly talked about, the meek shall inherit the earth. This was a guy who hung out with prostitutes and lepers. He was not someone who very much liked the fat cats of Jerusalem.
Right.
When did the evangelical movement marry people like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, who seemed to be very closely connected with the moneyed classes?
I think that happened in the 60s and 70s. I think if you look at the history of evangelical political engagement in America in the 20th century, it really began in 1960 when a lot of evangelicals who were, in fact, interestingly enough, historically Democrat at that point, got their dander up in terms of trying to vote for John Kennedy, the Catholic. So they began to impose what they saw as these interesting cultural threats, you know, the notion of a Catholic president they perceived as a threat. And then you had the Supreme Court making its decisions about a state-sponsored prayer in school being unconstitutional, and some evangelicals perceived that as a threat to their way of life. And then you had sex education in the public schools. And so I think the thing to see is a lot of folks in the evangelical world became involved politically in opposition to change.
And to change, particularly about sexual mores. That was the thing that really
Not limited to that. I think it's beyond that, but certainly that's part of it. And I think the Republican Party was there then in the 60s in the form of Nixon and his Southern Strategy to say, look, we feel your pain. You know, we don't like those nasty Democrats, so come and join us. And we began to get a wooing in the 70s. And, of course, as you mentioned earlier, Ronald Reagan was quite gifted at reaching out and tapping into that evangelical discontent.
And now do you see a backlash? I mean, do you see people who, whether or not they agree on abortion and homosexuality, are going back to the New Testament and finding out, hey, Jesus really did care about poor people? What a surprise to some, perhaps, who haven't read the Bible.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as you know, in the last 7.5 years, the number of people living in domestic poverty has gone from around 31 million to 37 million. And a lot of these folks, these church folks, are managed through kitchens. They're handing out food, and they see that in their own communities, their own churches, that people are struggling to make ends meet. And guess what? They read their own scriptures, and they see that there's always been God has always been a preferential option for the poor in both the Christian Testament and the Hebrew Bible. So yeah, I think it's a connection of going back to their biblical roots, but also opening up their eyes to see what's going on in their own neighborhood and the two together.
when you talk about the Nixon strategy, Professor, I have to admit the first thing I think about is race. When I
Absolutely.
Think about Nixon stealing the white working class, if you will, from the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, I can't help but think of race. How much, I mean, it's not something evangelicals, I'm sure, want to admit publicly or talk about very much, but how much, in your view, does this switch over, the one that occurred in the 60s, have to do with race?
Oh, I think it was central. I think most evangelical churches, most white evangelical churches, were on the wrong side of the race question. And even some very conservative denominations, like the Southern Baptist Church today, recognized that. They realized that they were on the wrong side of the angels there. And so I think that was a fundamental issue. And I think, again, if you kind of fast forward to today, a lot of younger evangelicals who've grown up in multicultural schools where they've experienced a much more interesting diversity of human beings in their school and in their neighborhood, sort of look back on those days and say, how could this have happened?
So let's fast forward then to today. So we have Barack Obama, a person who is half African American, half white, actually, a person who is trying to reach out past these chasms of race, trying to reach out to people who haven't voted for Democratic in a while. You are the evangelical coordinator for Barack Obama's campaign, which I'm very honored to have you here. How do you reach past these chasms?
Well, the good news is that I simply tell people to look at what the senator has said and done in his own life. That he has worked for fighting poverty straight out of college. He's worked on racial reconciliation his entire public career. He embodies a set of values that I think lives out the sort of slogans of bringing change to the world. You look at his own faith, you look at his own values, and you look at the speeches he's given, and I think you find sort of a rich table there of ideas for folks to dive into and to digest and to see if, in fact, they don't sit well with their own values. So that's the good news, is that I don't have to go out with blue smoke and mirrors. I say, look at this guy, look at his values, look at what he says. You don't have to take my word for it. So in that sense, it's wonderful to be able to commend this guy, his actions, his rhetoric, his speeches, his values, to folks. And when they take a look at it, they respond, I think, quite positive.
Professor, how much of it, though, is lingo? How much of it is talking the talk? I mean, Barack Obama was raised practically an atheist, as he admits in his books. I don't think there's any secret there.
Right.
Until about 20 years ago, when he joined the United Trinity Church. And how much of it is simply able to talk a certain talk, and how much of it is real policies that evangelicals will go for?
I don't think talking the talk is going to work anymore. I think right now there is a fair amount of discontent among a lot of evangelicals that talk is cheap, and that any politician can gin up a good set of talking points. So, certainly speech is important, but I think also action matching that speech is also as important. So, I think
so what are Obama's actions that most appeal to evangelicals? You mentioned, of course, the community service he did right out of law school, helping poor people. Okay, that's right. Certainly a strong point. Well, what other things really appeal to evangelicals?
Well, I think he stands on the war in Iraq. That's actually where he first caught my attention as an ethics professor way back before the war started, I guess it was, when he gave that speech in 2002, when he's, at that point, a state senator. He gave a very bold speech on principle, on moral principle, saying this is the wrong war at the wrong time. And
yeah, that's another thing that interests me. I mean, you would think that Orthodox Christians, to use I'm trying to find a word that's not loaded. It's very hard not
right.
to find that word. I mean, Orthodox could mean Greek Orthodox, which is obviously not what I mean.
Right.
But, evangelicals, I think you've sort of defined as, let's say, more traditional, but, that can be offensive, too. But let's just say very strongly believing Christians of a certain ilk.
Right.
That's a dangerous word, too. But it would seem to me that anyone who reads the New Testament and strongly identifies with Jesus of Nazareth is going to lean toward pacifism. I mean, this is Mr. Turn the Other Cheek.
I would argue morally that whether you're a pacifist or a member of sort of the just war tradition, that the initial response of a Christian to a war is to say, I don't think so.
I mean, I would think that at the very least, a Christian, if not opposed to all wars, as the Quakers are, would at least say it's got to be a pretty good reason before I consider going to war.
Right.
And yet, you find, again, prior to now, whenever you think of evangelicals, or certainly fundamentalists, who as you've defined, take the Bible literally, they're the ones most likely to support an extremely aggressive U.S. foreign policy that's generally associated with Republicans. Have Republicans put one over on these evangelicals? Have they tricked them? Is it all Robertson and the deceased Falwell, convincing them that other things are more important?
I think it's important to see that even among evangelicals, support for this war has plummeted. So it may be the case, and I'd have to look at some data here, that evangelicals may be more easily tempted to support American war. But I think it's also the case that eventually they do come around, as we've seen in Iraq now, here 5 years in, that we need to get out. I think an amazing percentage of evangelicals are right there with the rest of the country. I don't want to overgeneralize, but I mean, I take your point that certainly at the beginning of the Iraq War, evangelical support for President Bush and his invasion of Iraq was quite high. There's no disputing that. So in that sense, I would agree with you. I think what you're saying is that maybe that impulse is not faithful to the best teaching of the Scripture.
I don't see it. And when I think of the longer term, I mean, when I think of an evangelical a century ago, one man classically comes to mind in the United States, and that's, of course, William Jennings Bryan. I mean, he was the evangelical, don't sacrifice us on a cross of gold, ran for president three times, and had huge amounts of support in all the areas that you would think would be rock rib Republican today. I mean, I'm talking about out west, the Plain State, places like Kansas and Nebraska and the reddest of the states. And, of course, he was a Democrat. And while, we can argue some racial issues, which I really, because Bryan was definitely not a perfect man, at least with regard to white people, he looked out for the working classes. He really, really cared about the poor. And I'm just curious if you think that there's been a rebirth in evangelicals to say, well, wait a minute, we do have to care about the poor. This is essential to New Testament teaching.
Well, clearly something is afoot. I think it's premature to say that there's some kind of reformation going on within the evangelical world. But certainly you look at the younger demographic, you look at under 30 evangelicals, and there's far more concern there for the poor and the marginalized in society and around the globe. And now, given another 10 years, we'll know if it's a real trend or not. But certainly there are things cooking there. You talk to folks who teach in evangelical Christian colleges. You hear this. You see it, how well Jim Wallace's books sell and things like that. So certainly there's a lot of anecdotal evidence out there to suggest that something like this may be going on. We're just going to need more time before we can sort of pronounce, oh, yeah, there's some kind of dramatic sea change at work here. But I do think an older generation of evangelical leaders are nervous because they see this groundswell starting in the under 30 generation.
Is Jim Wallace really the main sort of leader of it? I mean, it seems to me whenever I turn on the TV, I see a different brand of evangelicals. I'm not even talking about, Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. I think their time, well, Jerry Falwell, of course, died. But even Pat Robertson, it doesn't seem to be discussed as much today as like a Rod Parsley or a John Hagee. Do we see new leaders, progressive evangelicals who are coming out with maybe their own mega churches, someone who perhaps has endorsed Barack Obama? Is there some leader we should look toward?
Well, I don't want to get into specific people. I mean, one of the things I think is true in the evangelical world is that pastors are becoming more and more hesitant and reticent of actually endorsing politicians publicly. But certainly you do see there are folks like Brian McLaren in the emerging church movement that I take as a sign of discontent with kind of the old evangelicalism. That's a very robust subcurrent, I think, within evangelicalism today. So he's somebody whose work I would point to as well as evidence that things are changing. Then you have folks like Ron Sider, who in many ways is kind of the original prophet among a lot of progressive evangelicals. He founded Evangelicals for Social Action way back, I think, in the 60s, or at least in the 70s at the latest. So, yeah, they're there. I think they're not always picked up by the media, but I think you do get a sense that they're is an evangelical left emerging and an evangelical center that's emerging, which is going to be a little more politically independent, I think.
So Professor Casey, what will the Obama campaign do to reach out to evangelicals and to do so in a way that won't frighten those that do care very strongly about the separation of church and state and certainly don't want a specific government-written prayer in schools? Is it through the faith-based initiative, or how is Obama reaching out to them?
Well, I think he's showing up. I mean, he actually has spoken in a number of settings. Back in 2006, he spoke at the Call to Renewal Pentecost gathering in Washington, D.C., and made a groundbreaking speech there saying that Democrats need to show up and talk to people of faith. He's done a couple of forums on CNN. You may have seen them. He did one with Sojourners back in the spring of 2007. He just did one, a compassion forum at Messiah College in Grantham, Pennsylvania, which is an evangelical school. He and Senator Clinton both showed up and spoke at that. So he has a willingness to sort of show up and talk in their venue. And I think that's what you're going to continue to see the campaign do. And he's going to simply tell his own story about the role that faith played in his own life that helped him, as he was doing community organizing there on the south side of Chicago, realize that there was a connection between the work he was doing in the streets and the work that churches were doing inside the sanctuary. He's talked about that quite eloquently in his own books. So I think he's going to continue to do what he's done to this point.
Okay, so he's going to show up. That's good. Tell me this. What do evangelicals want that Obama can give? Many of them are strongly pro-life on abortion, and I don't think he can give there. Many of them are very much against gay rights, and I'm not so sure how much Obama can give there. What can he give that evangelicals want?
Well, I think one of the things we have not talked about is I think the frustration with the political gridlock in Washington, D.C. today. I think that just as the entire population is just sick and tired of the paralysis, it's not somehow that evangelicals are off in the corner and haven't noticed that they see the fact that very little gets done. And so I think they're attracted to this notion that he's going to try and transcend that gridlock. He's going to try to find a way to bring folks on both sides of the aisle together to get at the lack of accessible health insurance in the country, for instance.
John McCain seems to have his own problems with evangelicals. He doesn't seem to have – they don't warm to him perhaps like they did to a Mitt Romney or certainly to a Mike Huckabee. What can Obama provide evangelicals that John McCain can't?
Well, I mean, I really don't want to say anything negative about Senator McCain. I think he's an honorable man.
Well, we'll talk about policy. We won't talk about personality. What political? I mean, what policies? I'm not trying to be down on him personally. What policies can Obama provide the evangelical community that John McCain won't?
Well, look at health care. I mean, right there. I mean, I think Senator Obama has a plan to ensure the tens of millions of Americans who don't have health insurance. If you're an uninsured evangelical, that's an issue for you. I think Senator Obama's plan there is superior. I think he's going to try to find a way to provide affordable health insurance to everyone. That's number one. I think the war in Iraq, I think the senator has a plan to get out. Senator McCain has a plan to stay in. And I think on both of those issues, the evangelicals have a very, very keen interest right now. In terms of the economy, I'd say the same holds true. Senator Obama's going to aggressively work to get the economy back in even balance and even keel, and I don't think Senator McCain has that either. So I think those issues are going to resonate with the evangelical community as they will beyond them.
I'm curious to know what you think that we liberal non-evangelicals can do or should do without compromising our values, but to reach out as Americans to evangelicals in a way to talk about the values that we do share, looking out for the poor, caring about health care, bringing the troops home from Iraq, caring about the environment. We may disagree on prayer in schools or abortion, but there is a lot we agree on. What do you think can be done at a personal level for those, let's say, in the Obama coalition who might see differently on religious issues?
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head. I mean, part of it is be willing to talk. about the wider range of issues. You're going to look for the overlap, I guess. You're going to look for the consensus where you can find it. And, I mean, I'm not a politician, but it always struck me that if you're trying to get elected, part of what you're doing, you're trying to persuade folks who maybe aren't necessarily reflexively in your camp. And I think part of the tragedy of the gridlock in Washington is it's almost become to the point where I can't walk across the room and talk with somebody who I know might disagree with me on a couple of big issues. And I think that's truly tragic. I want to believe that American democracy is strong enough that progressives can reach out a hand to a centrist or somebody on, you know, maybe center-right and say, look, can't we find a way to get at some of these huge issues? Because if we don't, I mean, if we're going to solve global poverty, if we're going to solve global warming, it's going to be because people of goodwill across a broad philosophical and political spectrum find a way to talk to each other and find a solution. If we just keep going into our corners and throwing rocks at each other, the planet's going to be cooked.
I couldn't agree with you more. I firmly welcome, in fact, I do have some fundamental listeners, I know, because they post on my blog, and I'm very glad to have you. They know how I feel. They know I'm pro-choice and pro-gay rights, but we do agree on the environment. We do agree about taking care of the poor, and we do very much have to talk to each other. Professor Casey, sounds like you're doing a terrific job for the Obama campaign. Thank you very much for coming here on the Inside Scoop and telling us, giving us some history and telling us what you plan to do.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for the invitation, Mark. It's been great.
My pleasure. If you want to call in, folks, and discuss this, Professor Casey has to go, but I'd like to talk with you. The toll-free number is 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Is there a chance, as Professor Casey says, for Obama to get a significant part of the evangelical vote? Is there change? Are young evangelicals coming around to support old principles of the New Testament that have been disregarded by many modern-day evangelicals? Or is this all just a pipe dream? What do you think? 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
If you or someone close to you has a hearing loss, here is some great news. Thousands of Open Caption videos are yours to borrow, and it's all free. Open Caption videos make it possible for the hearing impaired to understand television. The Caption Media Program offers classic Hollywood movies, special interest, and educational videos. Visit us online at cfv.org or call 1-800-237-6213. You can register to be a user and make your selections from our online or printed catalog. It's just that easy, and we'll even pay for the postage. Open Caption videos are perfect for the classroom, your home, or even the workplace. The nonprofit Caption Media Program is funded by the U.S. Department of Education and administered by the National Association of the Deaf. Tell a family member or a friend about the Caption Media Program today. Bookmark cfv.org for free loan Open Caption videos or call 1-800-237-6213.
from Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Well, it does seem like a contradiction, I'll grant you. Obama and evangelicals, who could think of them as allies? It seems that with things like the New Yorker cartoon coming out, that evangelicals are Obama's worst nightmare, not his friend. But then I hear from people like Professor Casey, and no doubt Sean Casey is an honorable man, and no doubt he's trying as hard as he can. We, I think, must always recognize that there are liberal Christians out there. And, you know, I'm still a little unclear about the definition. I think Sean Casey was, too. He did define fundamentalist, I think, someone who takes the Bible literally. I got that definition down. Evangelicals, I'm still not sure what that means. But let's just say someone who takes a certain view of Christianity very seriously. That's about the best as I can label it. But there are all elements to that. And as I've long argued, if you are true to the New Testament, if you strongly believe in Jesus of Nazareth and that Jesus is the Son of God, that his teachings are what matters most, if that's how you want to dedicate your life, well, then you got to look out for poor people. You got to. And you really can't care that much about money. And you got to care about those people who are least among us, right? I mean, I've never understood why those that call themselves evangelicals, I'm always troubled with all these definitions. Let's just call them radical rightists. Radical right-wing fundamentalists. Then you know who I'm talking about. But they're going around, they're condemning gay people, and yet Jesus hung out with prostitutes. Jesus hung out with lepers. Lepers and prostitutes, the lowest of the low, the most hated of society, the most feared, the most despised, the most discriminated against, and that's who he hung out with. Those were his friends. He didn't hang out with the fat cats of Jerusalem, as I put it, and yet, there's Rod Parsley, right? He's going on air saying, well, you know, if you're rich, then you're a good Christian. If you're poor, well, then I guess you're a bad Christian because God's punishing you. So give me money, and I'll put it in my little pyramid scheme, and lo and behold, you'll be rich again. Sounds to me like Rod Parsley is not so different from some of those priests who wanted sacrifices, or frankly, some of the Catholics who were selling pardons at the time of Martin Luther. But there are liberal evangelicals out there. Jim Wallace is the most famous. And I thought it was interesting the way at least Professor Casey seemed to think there's a good 30% that could vote either way. And I've always wondered how much of it is the unspoken question of race. I mean, black evangelicals tend to be almost as, maybe sometimes as conservative as the white ones. I know, I've had a number of them on my show, and they've said things that were anti-choice and anti-gay rights as strongly as any of the white people talk about. And yet, the fact that Obama is half black makes a huge difference in how they respect him as a Christian, right? They just don't trust him. And I think that's largely because of it. I don't know. I do wish him well. I do think he's got a chance. And I do want to always reach out and dialogue with people. Frankly, I think that the old issues of abortion and homosexuality are going by the wayside because I think that even evangelicals who think those things are a problem realize we face much graver problems. I mean, when you have children starving on earth, it's really hard to get worked up about a bunch of potential lives, right? Save the fetus, kill the child. It's a hard thing to sell. I mean, look at the stem cell research debate, where you can buy, yes, destroying an embryo that will never see the light of day, one of the 400,000 frozen embryos that are going to be discarded. You can save a life. You can save a child with Parkinson's. You can save someone perhaps with Alzheimer's. Who knows all you can do? The idea that you have to say to little 14-year-old Mary who has, you know, is in high school or is has Parkinson's disease, I'm sorry, Mayor, you have to suffer because we don't want to take this, you know, tissue that's going to be thrown away anyway. It's really hard to do. I mean, I think it would be virtually impossible for any of these evangelicals, the conservative evangelicals, they may say whatever they would say on the radio, but can you imagine going up to a mother, an evangelical, radical, right-wing, fundamentalist woman, and saying to her, all right, your child, she's 16 years old, she's going to die unless we use some cells from an embryo that will never see the light of day. One of the 400,000 that's frozen, that can stay there frozen for a million years or get pitched in the trash, so your child can live. Are you going to tell your child to die? I guess there'll be some. Many of you enjoyed my show last week, my ode to penicillin, where I talked about the Christian Science movement. There are clearly people who would allow their children to die rather than use a stem cell to save their lives. But I just don't think there are that many. And on gay rights, you know, I think people are starting to get used to it. It was fascinating to me that, Vermont, when that happened, is civil unions. It was a huge thing. Now we've got 10, 11, I've lost count how many states offer civil unions, and it's hardly noticed. Then Massachusetts offered marriage. It was a big deal then. California. And now Massachusetts is changing its law so that people out of state can get married, and it's a yawn. It's a yawn. New Yorkers can now get married. Gay New Yorkers can get married. They can do it in California. They can do it in Massachusetts. They can do it in Canada. Hardly anybody notices anymore. Could it be that evangelicals are actually growing up? They're actually learning about the diversity that exists in America? It was interesting to me that Professor Casey talked about young evangelicals. Because it shows that the fact that Obama appeals to the young is true everywhere. Right? I mean, we know he appeals to African Americans. We know he appeals to young whites more than older whites. We know that he appeals to young Latinos more than older Latinos. Young Jews rather than older Jews. I mean, he appeals to the young. And lo and behold, he appeals to young evangelicals rather than older evangelicals. And I can't help but think that we can credit someone for that, that there's one man, or maybe two, who really deserve our thanks for bringing young people from all walks of life solidly into the Democratic Party. And it's the first time I've ever publicly thanked either of these people on the air. So thank you, Dick Cheney. Thank you, George Bush. Thank you, Cheney and Bush, for helping to create what I expect, hope, and dare I say pray, will be a strong Democratic majority for decades to come. Young people growing up under this lawless president, under a vice president that not only doesn't respect the Constitution, but spends all of our national wealth on useless wars, have presided over the worst economy in a generation, have left us with no solution to our oil crisis. Young people who've grown up under this and only this regime understand why they have to be a Democrat. What's interesting is that older people, those perhaps who think that this too shall pass, people old enough to remember failed Democratic presidents like Jimmy Carter, or fondly remembered Ronald Reagan, who, while I have problems with him, frankly was a icon of virtue compared to either Bush, most particularly this Bush. Older people perhaps have more of a sense of that things change, right? Democrats, Republicans, that they can both be good, they can both be bad. Young people have grown up under Bush. I mean, think about it today. If you are, 29 years old, You were 21 when the Supreme Court first gave the election to George Bush, and 17 the election before, which was the Clinton-Dole election. You couldn't vote. So if you are under 30 today, if you're 29 or less, the only president that you could vote for or against in your entire life is George W. Bush. It should be no surprise that people under 30 are so strongly supportive of Barack Obama. Apparently, even evangelical. I want to give you another chance to call in, 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. When we come back, I'm going to talk about Obama's trip abroad and how the press is treating it. And, well, just more gaffes that McCain is making at home. But please, I do want to encourage you to call in. Any topic is valid. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
There's one place on the web you can go that's so topical you can apply it liberally. WD40.com. WDYAD40.com. Wide Wally and Dicky are there. They're working hard every day to give you updates in the news, politics, and a great sense of humor. So stop on by and see the boys at WD40.com. A place where you can raise your voice and be heard. WD40.com. Your one-stop shop for all things progressive.
Each flash of lightning is dangerous, even the first. So head to safety before that first flash. Remember, you are in danger from a lightning strike if you can hear thunder. Learn more about lightning safety at www.lightningsafety.noaa.gov. Lightning kills. Play it safe. This message is brought to you by the Iowa High School Athletic Association and your local National Weather Service office.
Here's a little test for you. Identify the following water-saving devices around your home. Using water wisely is important since our growing population puts pressure on this limited resource. Ready? That's water-saving device number 19, your outdoor faucet. Check faucets, sprinklers, and hoses for drips or leaks to save water and money. That's your toothbrush, water-saving device number 54. Turn the faucet off while you brush and save up to 25 gallons a month. It's water-saving device number 11, your water bill. If it's unusually high, you could have a leak. Learn to detect and repair leaks by contacting your water provider. Last clue? That's BeWaterSmart.net, a helpful website full of water-saving tips from the Water Conservation Coalition and your local water provider. There are a number of ways to save water, and they all start with you. Water. Use it wisely.
The Native American Journalists Association is calling out to tomorrow's reporters, photographers, editors, and publishers to represent Native perspectives.
Today's agreement allows the Nebraska State Patrol and Winnebago Tribal Police to share enforcement.
The tribe is taking its concerns to the Bureau of Reclamation, which manages and
Native American inmates have filed suit against the prison.
Go to NAJA.com to learn more about membership and benefits. NAJA, raising the next generation of storytellers.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop, but the toll-free number is 877-4-HEAD-ON. I know folks in the chat room are defending Jimmy Carter. If you want to do that publicly, you know what to do. Pick up the phone and talk to me about it on the air. I want to talk a little bit about Obama's trip abroad, because I think he's actually doing a pretty good job. Part of just the sheer joy of seeing Obama make the trip, it's hard to convey sometimes, because here you have someone who I trust. I mean, I don't trust completely. He is a politician. But to see him go and to talk to the generals and to talk to the leaders, and guess what? They like his ideas. When the prime minister of Iraq says, oh, yeah, Obama, absolutely right. Get those troops out there by 2010. That's an amazing thing. And he's treated like sort of a hero around the globe. And it just, after all these years of watching George W. Bush go abroad and being worried, being concerned. I mean, I don't know if you heard what he did just recently. He was at a conference on global warming, and when the whole thing was done, he said goodbye from the world's greatest polluter. Yeah, he actually said that. Now, we are the world's greatest polluter. But, you know, Bush, he sort of said that with aplomb, with joy, like, ha-ha, like, we're the world's greatest polluter. We're ruining the planet. The petulance, the childishness of it. The irony is that here you have the one of the younger candidates that's ever run for president, not the youngest, of course, against the single oldest to ever run for a first term. And it seems like Obama is the mature one, not just compared to Bush, but even compared to McCain. McCain seems to be losing it. McCain seems to think we have troops stuck somewhere on the Iraq-Pakistan border. Of course, there's just one little problem with that, that there is no Iraq-Pakistan border. I mean, there's a country, it's called Iran, and it's in between Iraq and Pakistan. So take this, plus the fact that he's used the word Czechoslovakia twice, a nation that hasn't existed for at least a decade or so, and the fact that he confuses Sunnis and Shia. And John McCain really seems to be out to lunch with regard to foreign policy. Then you see Obama, and he's walking around, and he is talking with people, doing the kind of things that you would think a president would do. And it's really not even, you know, part of it I could say it's because he's brilliant, because Obama is, you know, knows how to bring people together. Honestly, I think it's because he's not George Bush. Our standards have gotten so low after these 8 years that a person that can go abroad, smile a little, talk seriously with people and not have egg on his face is seen as brilliant. I mean, I don't mean to pick on Obama here, but it's not that hard to be brilliant after George W. Bush. It's not that hard to be seen as a world leader after George Bush. And that's good. That's good for Obama. Because it means that, really, he can go nowhere but up. And I surely expect that he will. Meanwhile, back at home, John McCain is rummaging around, getting absolutely no press. And it's funny, because all the press feels that they want to be with Obama. I got to say, my favorite little thing that Obama did on his trip had to do with a snub at home. He invited the three networks to bring their anchors there, and that's why, yeah, Katie Couric and Brian Williams and all of them are there with him on the trip. But Chris Wallace of Fox News just didn't get an invitation. Maybe it was lost in the mail. But no, Fox News was not invited to attend the trip. Fox News, that has done so much to try to portray Obama as a closet Muslim, has done so much to try to make up things about him and to skewer Reverend Jeremiah Wright far more than Wright himself does. They didn't get invited on the trip. And maybe that means that the media will finally now try to be fair. I'm not arguing the media should be pro-Obama. I'm just saying, hey, maybe they should be fair to both sides. And let's focus on the candidates. For all the focus on Michelle Obama, which I think is largely unfair, I think of the New Yorker cartoon, I also think there's a certain fear, let's face it, of the angry black woman, right? There are a lot of, let's say it, white people who are afraid of a black woman who is upset about something, The irony is that Michelle Obama doesn't seem particularly angry at all. I don't usually see her going on and on. I mean, if there's any woman who I can think of angry in politics, I mean, Hillary Clinton or even Nancy Pelosi, many of them would come to mind. Or if you're talking about a wife of a candidate, there's no meaner person. There is no meaner first lady in politics than Barbara Bush. I mean, that is a mean old woman. And not just because she called Hillary Clinton, rhymes with witch and begins with the letter B. She's just a nasty person. I mean, I wouldn't say that about Laura Bush. Laura Bush, whatever. Right? But Barbara Bush clearly is a nasty old woman. That is an angry woman. Michelle Obama seems to me like a very young, hip person of my generation, who doesn't seem that striking to me. I mean, maybe because, you know, when I went to law school, I was used to having African-American women there in my classes and arguing with me about all the issues of the day, along with, the white women and the white men and the African-American men and the Latinos and Asians and everybody else. But I think it harkens back to the 60s. I mean, the New Yorker piece does, I think, reach out to a primal fear that a black woman upends everything, right? Because she's not white and she's not a man, so she upends the hierarchy of misogyny and white privilege, two in one, and really scares people. And yet I find far more scary a certain demure beer heiress that has gotten virtually no attention in the news. Cindy McCain. Cindy will not disclose her tax filings. McCain will not disclose her. Cindy will not disclose her tax filings. McCain. Yeah, that works. The beer heiress, the one who apparently did have connections with Charles Keating, a woman who, it's confessed, had a painkiller problem. You know, they're not going to talk much about that on the right-wing network. But someone who, was sleeping with John McCain at the time he was married to somebody else. Again, something that I'm not that concerned about. But if Bill Clinton did that, wouldn't Republicans be all over it? No, what I'm mostly concerned about is what she's hiding. What she's hiding in her tax returns. I mean, this is a woman who very proudly said she was afraid of flying, so she went and she got her pilot's license in Arizona, because, quote, you can't drive long distances in Arizona, unquote. You can't? I mean, it takes a while, but I've crossed Arizona. I drove from Tennessee to Los Angeles, crossing, yes, New Mexico and Arizona. It's a big state. But I would bet that most Arizonans don't have a private plane. I'd just be willing to bet that most Arizonans get around by driving. Maybe by flying. Maybe by taking a bus. Certainly not in their private jets. But this is a woman who, without thinking, says, oh, well, the only way to get around Arizona is by private jet. And by doing so, excludes 99.9% of Arizonans. And for all the talk about Michelle Obama and how she can't relate to Americans because, it's the first time she's really proud of her country is when Barack Obama's running for president, what about a Cindy McCain? What about a Cindy McCain who truly represents, more than anyone, the 1% of America that owns 90% of American wealth? That truly represents someone who says, well, I got to take a private plane because you can't drive in Arizona. Cindy McCain, who's hiding something in her tax returns, some payoff to someone. I remember when Geraldine Ferraro ran for vice president under Walter Mondale, and they asked her some questions about her husband's business, John Zaccaro. And there was a huge discussion of, well, Geraldine Ferraro, what has your husband done? And what did she do? She turned over her return, her husband's return. She gave a press conference to answer everything that her husband did? Is this sexism here? Is that what it is? Yeah, I mean, they made Bill Clinton turn over his tax returns when Hillary ran. Why aren't we turning over Cindy McCain's tax returns? I mean, the reason why John McCain is in public, in politics, is because he married well. And that's okay. George Washington married well, too. Martha's wealth probably is the reason we had the first president we have today.